Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mr. Big Sting, The Cases, The Killers, The Controversial Confessions by Mark Stobie. Narrated by David Morantz. Chapter 1. An Introduction to Mr. Big. Susan Roberts was tired but happy on the evening of July 18, 1995. As she drifted off to sleep, her loving husband massaged her back. Her three children were in their cribs. Three-year-old Jonathan was hers from a previous relationship, while the 18-month-old twin boys, David and Josiah, were fathered by her husband. Susan did not notice her husband slipping a rope around her neck. Her evening took a turn for the worse as she experienced terror, then pain, then death when he strangled her. Her husband then strangled Josiah and set the house on fire with the expectation that this would kill Jonathan and David. He threw Josiah's corpse into a nearby wood and proceeded to a friend's house in order to play the role of the grieving husband and father when the news of his family's death was delivered to him. As it turned out, he was not completely successful in wiping out his family. Neighbors braved the flames to rescue Jonathan. David was scooped up from his crib by firefighters, but later died of smoke inhalation. On May 6, 1978, Monica Jack was riding her bicycle. The 12-year-old was headed to her home on the Quilchina Reserve, located northeast of Merritt, British Columbia. It was a beautiful spring evening. As Monica pedaled her bike alongside Nicola Lake, she had no idea that the man urinating in the bushes beside a parked camper truck had been convicted of rape in the past. When Monica attempted to pass by, the man pulled her off the bike. The girl was thrown into the camper, and her bike was thrown into the lake. The man drove to an isolated clearing in the forest. He raped Monica, then strangled her. He burned her body and clothing to destroy the evidence. After stuffing her charred remains under a log, the man departed. What was left of Monica's body was not discovered for 17 years. On June 8, 1994, Timothy Langmead was at work, a marijuana grow-op in Port Coquitlam. An old friend from high school showed up with two colleagues. It was not a social call. The trio tied Timothy to a chair while they stole 170 marijuana plants, a guitar, and a VCR. Either because they did not want to leave behind any witnesses, or because they were incompetent drunks, the robbers wrapped Timothy's head with 24 feet of duct tape. Timothy died. It is, after all, difficult to breathe through multiple layers of duct tape. Two of the robbers put Timothy's body in his van. They threw Timothy into the Fraser River and pushed his van over the edge of a cliff. July 16, 1996 was a beautiful summer day in Williams Lake, British Columbia. Joanne Fedema told her husband and children that she wanted to go for a bike ride. She set out for the Williams Lake dump, taking this road because it had little traffic. Unfortunately, one of the few people going to the dump that day was a distracted driver. He was changing stations on his pickup truck radio and did not see Joanne until the last second. He braked, but not in time. Joanne's bike was knocked over. She was unhurt, but unhappy. As she expressed her displeasure at the man's driving, he decided the best way to shut her up was to hit her over the head with a pipe wrench. This caved in Joanne's skull. The man threw the bike into the ditch and Joanne's body into his truck. He drove a mile further down the road and then took her a short distance into the forest. He pulled off her clothes and mutilated her genitalia so that the police would look for sexual predators. He hurried home. His wife and children believed he had been home all morning. In the spring of 2004, Darlene Bossy had just finished her third year of the education program at the University of Saskatchewan. On May 16th, she went for supper with friends from her home on the Onion Lake First Nation Reserve and then to a meeting of a First Nations organization in Saskatoon. After the meeting, she decided to stop by a nightclub. There she got tipsy, met a guy, danced with him, and eventually agreed to go for a ride in the country. The man's hopes for an exciting sexual encounter did not work out as he had anticipated, so he strangled Darlene. He burned her body and put her charred remains in a small depression in the ground. He spotted an old abandoned refrigerator lying nearby, so he threw it on top of her. On January 12, 2012, Fribjon Bjornsson was a happy young man. The 28-year-old father of two had just cashed his paycheck from his work with a log processing company. He decided to stop by the house of local drug dealers in Fort St. James, British Columbia, in order to buy a little illicit pleasure for the weekend. The three drug dealers robbed Fribjon and beat him mercilessly. They turned assault into murder by strangling Fribjon with an electrical cord and beheading him. Fribjon's body was hidden under a logjam on a river island while his head was stored in the basement. The murderers used Fribjon's $2,500 to buy a new snowmobile. In the spring of 1994, Jody Franz's life was hard. She was broke and separating from her husband. Her husband was harassing her and filing unfounded sexual abuse allegations against Jody's new boyfriend. April 8th was to be a big day. She had an appointment with her lawyer to sign a petition for divorce and a meeting with the police to provide a written synopsis of her husband's harassment. Late in the evening of April 7th, Jody's husband called her to plead for a meeting. She reluctantly agreed. Her husband strangled Jody and dismembered her into six pieces. He threw Jody's head into the mouth of the Harrison River. From there, it entered the Fraser River and was never seen again. Her husband threw the rest of Jody's body into the manure treatment pond of a dairy farm where he had once worked. The chemical and aeration action dissolved her. About 4 months later, the molecules that had once been a person were spread, along with cow manure, over a farmer's field. In November 2011, Mika Jordan was a happy and friendly 6-year-old. Her parents were divorced, but Mika appeared happy staying with her father during the week and her mother on weekends. This changed on Thursday, November 10th. Her father's girlfriend disciplined Mika by holding the girl's hand over the flame of a cigarette lighter. Mika's father did not want her mother to find out about the resulting third-degree burn. He told Mika's mother that his girlfriend had dumped him and asked if Mika could stay for the weekend. Mika's mother consented. She never saw her daughter alive again. Mika's father and his girlfriend launched a bizarre spiral of abuse when Mika complained that her hand hurt. She was ordered to run up and down the stairs as discipline for complaining. When Mika ran out of breath, her father punched her in the stomach for slowing down. When this blow caused Mika to run even slower, he took to banging her head against the wall. By Sunday afternoon, Mika was dying. Her father called 911 and claimed his daughter had fallen down the stairs. The Edibako family had fled from strife and disorder in Central Africa to refuge in Vancouver. On May 15, 2006, the family was awakened by an explosion followed by a rush of flames. Adela Edibako was burned alive. So were her daughters Editha, 12, Benedicta, 9, and Stephanie, 8. Adela's son, Bolingo, 19, was severely burned but survived by jumping out of a window. Bolingo's girlfriend, 17-year-old Ashley Singh, was also sleeping in the house and was also burned alive. The explosion and fire were deliberately created by a man seeking revenge because Bolingo had told police he'd seen the man stab someone. The man broke a window, poured 5 cans of gasoline into the house, and tossed a lit propane torch inside. September 26, 1981, was a Friday. In Dawson Creek, British Columbia, Earl Jones took his wife to the bar for a few drinks. A stranger crudely propositioned Jones's wife. Earl objected by slapping the man across the face. The stranger left. All in all, a typical barroom kerfuffle, but this time it was different. The stranger waited outside in his pickup truck. When Earl and his wife started home, they noticed the truck following them. When they came to a stop sign, the back window of their car shattered. Earl was hit in the head with a bullet from a .303 rifle. He died instantly. In August 1995, Clara Losky was 95. She lived alone and was proud of her independence. One Friday afternoon, two men forced their way into her home. Clara's hands were tied behind her back with wire. Her feet were bound. Her hands and feet were tied together. Clothing was wrapped around Clara's head. She was thrown onto her bed while the two men ransacked the house looking for money. Then they left. Clara was alone, tied up, in the dark. Clara was gutsy. She struggled in an attempt to get free. The wire cut into her wrists and ankles. She continued to struggle for at least 24 hours. Eventually, her false teeth came loose and lodged in her throat. Clara died. Mr. Big appears. These examples show the value of an investigative technique known as Mr. Big. These were very different crimes. The nature of the victims, the cause of death, and the motivations of the killers were profoundly different. Some victims were young, some were old, some were men, some were women. Some were disreputable characters engaged in criminal activity, while some were innocent of any bad behavior. Some were shot, some were strangled, and some were burned alive. Some of these killings were motivated by greed, some by anger, and some by sheer stupidity. There were similarities. None of these people deserved to die. All left loved ones behind who mourned their loss and longed for some semblance of justice. In all these cases, the police were frustrated by the harsh reality that their investigations were only partially successful. Police had identified the murderer, but could not prove it in a way that would satisfy a judge or jury. Mr. Big was created in order to gather evidence and, where appropriate and possible, get a conviction. Mr. Big was not born. He was invented. The 5 W's of journalism are who, where, when, what, and why. The only group that might know the answer to the first three questions regarding Mr. Big is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP. But if this information is recorded in their files, the RCMP is not sharing. But we can make some inferences with informed speculation. Mr. Big was created by an RCMP officer, but we don't know which one. He was first created in British Columbia. The earliest Mr. Big cases were conducted in that province, but we don't know where. We know that Mr. Big was created in the late 1980s or early 1990s, but we don't know the day, month, or year. We can answer the what question. Mr. Big is an undercover operation in which police attempt to trick a suspect to disclose a serious crime by convincing him that he is joining a criminal gang. This brings us to why. Almost always when Mr. Big was used, the police were confronted with a brutal murder, a suspect, and a lack of proof on which to convict the suspect. Often the suspect had been interrogated, but either denied committing the crime or followed the standard lawyer's advice of just shut the fuck up. In many cases, the police wanted to file charges, but a prosecutor said there was not enough evidence to get a conviction. In one of these tense and frustrating cases, some RCMP officer had a bizarre idea. Why not have an undercover police officer befriend the suspect by pretending to be a criminal? Why not pretend to recruit the suspect into an imaginary criminal gang? Why not introduce the suspect to the imaginary leader of this imaginary criminal gang? Why not call this imaginary crime leader Mr. Big? Maybe the suspect could be persuaded to tell Mr. Big about committing the crime. Maybe they could get the suspect to convict himself with his own words. My guess is that the initial reaction to this suggestion was amusement and incredulity. There were likely jokes from other police officers that the imaginative officer had been smoking British Columbia's largest illicit cash crop. The other police officers probably mocked the suggestion. No criminal, no matter how dumb, would be dumb enough to fall for that one. But desperate situations lead to desperate measures. Everyone involved was likely amazed that it worked. But because it worked, it was used again, and again, and again. We don't know how many times Mr. Big has been used. The RCMP has made the general statement that it has used Mr. Big about 350 times. That's probably reasonably accurate, but it's impossible to verify. Other police forces in Canada have gotten into the act. The technique has been copied in countries such as Australia and New Zealand. In researching this book, I've located 127 times that Mr. Big was created to investigate someone suspected of homicide, and 8 times he was created to investigate people suspected of crimes other than homicide. These included crimes such as launching violent home invasions and dynamiting a house in which 3 people were sleeping. In addition, I located one case in which the police made the very unwise decision to create Mr. Big in order to get an eyewitness identification from a witness who was either unable or unwilling to tell police who had killed his friend. Neither I nor other researchers have been able to find a record of all Mr. Big cases. If a suspect is smart enough to understand that his new curious friends are likely police officers, the operation will end with no public record. If the suspect is convinced that Mr. Big is really a powerful leader of a criminal gang, but the suspect is innocent and smart enough to not make up a story, the operation will usually, but not always, remain invisible. The suspect may never know that his criminal friends who so mysteriously appeared and disappeared were actually undercover police officers. Even those cases where the suspect confessed, got convicted, and went to jail may remain invisible to researchers. The durable artifacts created by the justice system are reported judicial decisions and media reports of trials. If an accused pleads guilty and there is agreement between the prosecution and defense about the recommended sentence, there is no reason for the judge to write a decision. If a defense lawyer does not object to the prosecution using the evidence generated by Mr. Big to the jury, and if the accused is convicted of first-degree murder, the trial itself will produce no written decisions by the trial judge. If the convicted murderer accepts his fate, there will be no appeal court decision. If the person who was killed was powerless, poor, or disreputable, there will usually be little or no media interest. If the trial takes place in a smaller town, media coverage will be local and difficult to locate. Of the 127 homicide cases I located in which Mr. Big was called in, only 6 suspects told Mr. Big that they had not killed the victim. A few of these suspects were charged even without this disclosure, while others were convicted of lesser offenses, such as committing an indignity to a dead body. There are certainly other cases where a suspect denied being a killer. If no charges emerge from the investigation, it remains invisible. In 121 of the homicide cases I examined while researching this book, the suspect told Mr. Big they killed or helped kill the victim. Of these, 51 were convicted of first-degree murder, 39 of second-degree murder, 10 of manslaughter, and 1 of conspiracy to commit murder. 5 more were convicted of murder but had their convictions overturned on appeal. Five were charged, but had the charges withdrawn or stayed after the courts ruled their disclosures to Mr. Big inadmissible as evidence. Nine were charged but acquitted, and one received an immunity agreement in exchange for testimony against his colleagues. Those telling Mr. Big about their crimes often implicated others. The Mr. Big cases I've examined resulted in another 46 people being charged with various offenses. Of these, 16 were convicted of first-degree murder, 2 of second-degree murder, 7 of manslaughter, and 1 of attempted murder. 10 were convicted of offenses such as conspiracy to commit murder, accessory after the fact, or committing an indignity to a dead body. 7 were acquitted of charges. 2 were convicted of first-degree murder, but had their conviction overturned on an appeal centering on the instructions the jury received on how to deal with hearsay evidence. They are waiting for their second trial. The bottom line is that if a person tells Mr. Big they have killed someone, they and their associates have a very good chance of going to jail for a very long time. Even those eventually acquitted can end up being locked up for years or even over a decade while their cases wind their way through the courts. Of the 121 suspects who told Mr. Big they killed someone, 115 were men and 6 were women. Because of this overwhelming male composition of suspects in Mr. Big cases, I will be using the generic pronoun he. This gendered identification is not infallible, but it is substantively true. Killers caught by Mr. Big are almost always men. A lot of homicides have been solved by Mr. Big. Counting only cases where the accused was convicted and the conviction was ultimately upheld after the appeal process, I've identified 129 homicide victims for whom Mr. Big has been responsible for gaining justice. Again, this is an incomplete tally. Of the identified victims, 67, 52%, were women. Given that about 30% of homicide victims in Canada are female, Mr. Big is particularly effective in bringing to justice people guilty of the ultimate violent crime against women. Over a third of these murdered women in Mr. Big cases were killed by an intimate partner, compared to just under a fifth of all cleared Canadian homicides over the past 2 decades. Several of the Mr. Big intimate partner homicides were carefully planned or were contract killings. Both planned and contract murders are more difficult crimes for the police to solve using traditional methods of detection than are the impulsive, unplanned, and semi-accidental killings that make up the majority of intimate partner killings. Iqbal Gill hired a man to run over his wife in a hit-and-run accident in order to collect a $3 million insurance policy. David Knight hired a man to strangle his wife in a staged home break-in in order to free himself to marry his mistress in Florida. Both these men were respectable business people and leaders in the community. Both had impeccable alibis. Both got away with murder until Mr. Big struck up a conversation. While the female victims of murderers caught by Mr. Big were disproportionately victims of intimate partner violence, the male victims were disproportionately murdered as a byproduct of involvement in an illegal drug trade. Just over 40% of the male victims were killed either as a result of turf struggles in the drug trade or as an accompaniment to a drug trade-related robbery, or both. This victim profile also makes detection more difficult using traditional means. There is often a surplus of potential suspects, and potential witnesses often have compelling reasons to be uncooperative with police. Some male victims don't need to be involved in the illicit drug trade in order for police to be confounded with a plethora of motivated suspects. In 1979, a Winnipeg man was found floating in the Red River with his head bashed in. He was such an objectionable character that police quickly compiled a list of 11 people with a strong motive for the killing. The investigation stalled because the finger of suspicion pointed in too many directions. 18 years later, Thomas Griffin told Mr. Big he had committed the crime because the man had tried to stab him in an unprovoked attack in a bar earlier that evening. This attack initially caused Griffin to be ranked 11th on the suspect list. The means of killing in Mr. Big cases are different by gender. The most common method of killing someone in Canada is stabbing. The second most common is shooting, and the third is beating someone to death, usually with the assistance of an object. Both stabbing and beating are messy. Blood, hair, and pieces of bone from the victim are strewn about. If a person is killed by stabbing or beating, the crime scene is almost impossible to clean adequately enough to avoid detection, and the killer is usually covered with gore. DNA from the blood of the victim found on the killer's shoes or clothing is enough to make a compelling argument for conviction. Many victims in Mr. Big cases were murdered in ways that made forensic-based detection more difficult. The male victims in Mr. Big cases were shot in over 42% of cases, compared to the usual Canadian rate of 30% of homicides. Shooting kills at a distance and does not allow the victim to directly engage with the killer. As a result, the killer's DNA or fingerprints are often missing from the crime scene when someone has been shot. Female victims were strangled in 36% of cases resolved using Mr. Big, compared to under 9% for all Canadian homicides over the past two decades. Strangling is up close and personal. It's not easy to strangle someone, so women are strangled more often than men because of differentials in size and strength. For a killer, strangling has the great advantage of cleanliness. Strangling does not leave behind blood that provides a rich field of forensic evidence to be harvested by today's highly skilled crime scene forensics experts. These gendered peculiarities in both the killer-victim relationship and the means of causing death create gendered difficulties for police detection, but regardless of the gender of the victim, most Mr. Big cases present a common problem for police. The killers work really hard to avoid detection. They often show a remarkable, if chilling, level of cunning. This book examines how Mr. Big obtained justice for 129 homicide victims. Their killer's attempt to avoid detection included transportation and concealment. The bodies of 21 victims were transported from the crime scene and hidden elsewhere. Discovery of the remains sometimes came weeks or years later. This transportation and concealment of corpses delayed the start of the homicide investigation and made it more difficult for the police to obtain meaningful testimony from someone who might have seen or heard something relevant. The movement of the body can make the location of the killing impossible to find, thereby eliminating the source of most forensic evidence. Finally, transportation and concealment can destroy any possibility of police getting useful results from medical examinations. For example, in one case, the victim was found only when someone saw their dog chewing on a skull. The victim's body had been pulled apart, partially eaten, and spread around by animals. This made establishing the cause of death impossible. Transportation and really good concealment. In another 19 cases, the body was concealed so well that it was not discovered until the killer told or showed Mr. Big where the remains were hidden. In three cases, the killer could not even recover the body. As described earlier, Jody Franz's body was converted into fertilizer and spread over a field. In another case, the body was completely burned. In a third, the body was thrown into a major river and never recovered. Homicides with no body not only present challenges inherent in transportation and concealment, but also make it very difficult to even prove that the victim has been killed. After Alan Scheibach strangled his wife and buried her in his basement, pouring new concrete as part of the concealment, he used her cell phone, email, and voicemail to create an elaborate electronic record to suggest that she was alive for several weeks after going missing. Until he told Mr. Big where her remains were hidden, the
sample complete. Ready to continue?